From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, a divide opens up in the cost of services for domestic abuse victims. Then, Lake Effect SAS Young Kim says coercing food stamp recipients to buy only healthy food is the wrong way to go about it.
I'd like to live in a Milwaukee where people take responsibility for their health, where they eat vegetables not because they're forced to, but because they want to. That's what real change looks like.
The search for extraterrestrial life is about to get really interesting.
We live at a very special time in the history of astronomy. We are poised to find planets enough like the Earth that we could imagine them being comfortable for life as we know it.
And an eye researcher takes a page from the playbook of astronomers. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company this morning. As the Affordable Care Act goes into full effect next year, one area that will see changes is in health screenings and counseling for domestic abuse victims. Under the provisions of the Act, costs for those services will be completely covered for people with private medical insurance. But a disparity is also opening up, as people on BadgerCare, Wisconsin's subsidized health care system for the poor, would see increases in out-of-pocket costs for those same services. That change is the subject of a special report published this week at the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Brendan O'Brien covered the story, and he joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in the studio and explained how significant the changes could be.
Well, it's significant at a couple of levels. First of all, we're dealing with the poorest of the poor, people who are fragile. They are also dealing with a very traumatic, stressful period of their lives. Episodes of their lives, and any change is magnified. So when we're talking about a change in copay, a change in access, even the slightest change, even the difference between $10 and $20 or the difference between going to this clinic or that clinic or seeing a new doctor is really significant. These people are extremely fragile in their states.
Well, and so how did it get on your radar screen in the first place? I mean, presumably it being this big a deal is what you got you looking into it. But where did the story start for you?
The story started with taking a look at not just the fiscal implications of the governor refusing to expand Medicaid, but also the policy implications. What does this mean for those, again, who are the poorest of the poor? And what does this mean for their health care? And so we started digging into the policy implications of the Affordable Care Act, what it means for the rules and regulations, and how it plays out with BadgerCare.
Well, so let's take a step back before we get any further here. How are screenings and counseling for domestic abuse victims covered right now under the current system?
They're basically covered through small copays, and BadgerCare is based on its income based. So some people pay a deductible, some people don't. It depends on your income. So let's say you are in an emergency room and you have been physically abused. The screening takes place throughout the exam, and that is covered as a hospital visit. The screening is basically not something that shows up on a bill. What shows up on a bill is those long-term counseling visits through a period of time, through 2, 3, 4, maybe even 7 years. So that is where some of this is cropping up. It's not necessarily the screening, which is a best practice, such as having your weight checked in the emergency room. Where the real drive in this, where the real concern is those that are bent on counseling, are they going to be covered the same way as in the future?
One of the interesting things about this article that you write about is the notion that screening doesn't necessarily turn up domestic abuse the first time through. This is kind of an ongoing basis.
Yes, and that's the reason why the best practice is such. That is, it is screenings happen every time you walk into a physician's office, every time you walk into a hospital room. An emergency room. There are screenings. The portions of the screenings are direct questions, but other portions of the screenings are just the doctor viewing taking notes about your mannerisms and about the way your mental state and about your mental facilities. And so these screenings are both direct and indirect. And over time, what doctors hope that happens is it fishes out if you are repeatedly asked the question if you have been abused or if the topic comes up enough. You are going to eventually say yes if you are a victim. And then that's when the true care and treatment begins. That's when you can get into counseling.
And you say, and as you write, the counseling aspect can play out over a very long period.
In some cases, it can play out for a number of years. So one of the sources of my story is a woman by the name of Roxy who has been in counseling for 7 years. A portion of that time was when she was still living with her abuser. She would secretly take trips to counseling visits during her workday.
Even as she was being abused at home?
Yes. Yeah. And that, I think, was about three.
Yeah, I think you're right. Three years worse. Yeah,
3 years.
Yeah.
And she says that it's long term. It's not something that happens overnight. It's definitely not something that happens in a few visits. It takes time. It's a rejiggering of the mindset emotionally, spiritually, and it's also a rejiggering of your whole being, of who you are, what you believe in, your self-worth, your self-respect. And so all this has to be reconfigured, and that's why counseling is such an important, critical component to healing from domestic violence.
And presumably a change in copays, even as you say, if it's from $10 to $20 over the course of 5, 6, 7 years, this, you could be talking about a lot of money.
You can also be talking about decisions that the poor have to make. Most people don't have to make a huge decision between either spending $10 or $20. Well, when you're really poor, $10 could mean either buying dinner or going to a counseling session 5 miles away on a bus on a cold winter day. The decisions that the poor make are that much more magnified, and they are, in some cases, in this case, they could be life or death, and it's about survival. So when we're talking about access and copays, even a small difference really matters to the poor.
So there are still a lot of questions remaining about how the cost of these services might be divided in the future. What's the reason behind the uncertainty?
It goes back to what the governor did in February in not expanding – his choice not to expand Medicaid. In doing so, it is unclear whether our Medicaid program, BadgerCare, has to follow the Affordable Act
– Affordable Care Act, yeah.
Yeah, Affordable Care Act provisions. And it's still unclear to this day – his decisions, his proposals, the changes that he proposes to make with BadgerCare, how those might play out when it comes to the Affordable Care Act. Right now, what is happening is we have a situation potentially where those that are on BadgerCare or those that were on BadgerCare and they're being kicked off are going to have less availability or more costs in front of them when it comes to domestic screenings and counseling compared to those that are on private insurance.
But one of the things I gather that's going to determine the answers to these questions is whether the federal government signs off on Wisconsin's plan, correct?
You bet. You bet. It all has to do with waivers. Also has to do with whether they're changing the current plan, whether it is a new waiver, whether it's amending a waiver. And it gets really inside baseball and really inside the bureaucratic red tape that goes on between Washington and Madison.
You spoke with people involved in both screening and counseling services. What are they saying about these uncertainties?
Obviously, it's unclear, but they're concerned. Again, any change that we make, that the state makes when it comes to the most fragile population, the poor, when it comes to the most horrendous situations in our lives, it's concerning, especially for the experts that sit there day in and day out and advocate for these people.
How about the state? Is this on the state's radar screen? And what are state officials saying?
Not much. It is on their radar screen. They understand that there needs to be some questions answered. The federal government has until January 1st. So it's on their radar screen, but they are it's a lot. I have a feeling there's a lot of conversation between them and Washington officials.
As you said, you spoke with one domestic abuse victim who either is still in or was in counseling for a long period of time. What's her take on this whole situation? How big a difference would this have made to her?
Life or death. She said during her interview that without counseling, she would have killed herself. So to say the least, it is a critical issue for her. It is concerning for her that there is any type of change. Again, even if it is a slight change in access or a slight change in copay or deductibles, out-of-pocket costs, is really concerning for her.
As a reporter, this must have been a troublesome story for you to cover.
Difficult and troublesome. Difficult because the Affordable Care Act, healthcare policy, Badger Care, when it comes down to it, is a very difficult, complex set of factors, issues, economic factors that are at play. And what I have described for people, it's almost like a Rube Goldberg comic that you can't really see play out yet. So that's one of the real difficulties in this, is we just don't know how everything is going to hinge on everything else. And decisions, again, that are made in Washington and Madison might trickle down to the poorest of the poor and change their coverage of this very critical set of healthcare services.
Brennan O'Brien, thanks so much, and hope we can follow up on the story down the road.
You bet. Thank you.
Brendan O'Brien is a reporter with the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. His report on changes in costs for health screenings and counseling for domestic abuse victims was published this week. There's a link to it from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Brendan O'Brien spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. A proposal to mandate the way food stamps are being used is working its way through the Wisconsin legislature. Coming up next, Lake Effect essayist Young Kim suggests a different approach. Stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Assembly Bill 110 is wending its way through the Wisconsin State Legislature, and analysts say there is a fair chance it will pass. The bill requires food stamp recipients to spend at least two-thirds of their benefits on healthy foods, such as bread, milk, and vegetables. The bill is backed by good intentions, but Lake Effect essayist Young Kim says he believes it's the wrong approach.
Potato chips, sodas, and other nutritionally empty foods are everywhere these days. And the last people who should be eating them are poor people who don't have health insurance or regular checkups. But my 10 years of trying to get more veggies into Milwaukee stomachs tells me that this bill is flawed. The food retail system in our inner city isn't set up to deliver the goods. This bill is the equivalent of slapping a Band-Aid on skin cancer. Corner convenience stores are the main food source for Milwaukee's poor. Some stores do have fruits and vegetables, but they're more expensive and of poorer quality, mainly because our nation's food distribution system is not geared to serve mom-and-pop corner stores. Being poor means going without time-saving conveniences that many of us take for granted. Not having a car puts the better-stocked and more affordable suburban grocers out of reach. Go into any Milwaukee convenience store and try to make a salad out of what you find there. You simply can't. Leveling the food field is an enormous puzzle, but Milwaukee already has many of the pieces. Dozens of agencies like mine are going at it from an array of angles, like Urban Gardens and Perry Urban Farms, designed to supply the city with affordable produce, or linking urban vegetable production with jobs to supply veggies to corner stores. Just last year, our city's Office of Environmental Sustainability created the homegrown concept and pitched it to the Bloomberg Philanthropies Mayor's Challenge. Competing with over 300 cities, Milwaukee came just shy of winning. But the idea of urban homesteading to transform foreclosed properties into food production lots and aggregating veggies with a food hub to take advantage of the economies of scale holds so much promise for community transformation. But the most troubling aspect of the bill is the introduction of a coercive element to a select part of our population. As I learned when my own daughter turned 2, coercion around food is not a strategy for long-term success. I'd like to live in a Milwaukee where people take responsibility for their health, where they eat vegetables not because they're forced to, but because they want to. That's what real change looks like. And everywhere I look in Milwaukee, diets are changing. Recently, the Fondue Market had to add a new soul category to its collard greens cooking contest to accommodate all of the entries that were vegetarian and salt-free. I want a Milwaukee where people who make poor dietary choices have to live with the consequences. But before we reach that level of personal responsibility, people need exactly that, choices. Apples and broccoli have to be right next to candy and soda. As things stand now, healthy eating in the inner city won't happen on a large scale if it's too much of a pain in the neck. Wisconsinites value frugality and want tax dollars used wisely, and stories of food stamps being spent on sodas fly in the face of these values. But even supporters of this bill admit they don't have any data that shows what percentage of food stamps are spent on junk food. Their evidence is purely anecdotal. But we do know that our federal government spends $20 billion each year to prop up the prices of commodity crops like corn and soybeans, a practice that hides the real cost of food and makes it possible to sell a 390-calorie double cheeseburger for a dollar and still make a profit. That's what Wisconsin should be upset about. If the bill passes, Wisconsin will apply to the USDA for a waiver to enact these changes to this federal program. History says this waiver won't be approved. Minnesota tried in 2004 and New York City in 2010. Both times, the requests were denied because healthy food is impossible to define. And so we'll be back to where we started, only worse. This food stamp bill is a wedge that will only widen the gulf of misunderstanding between the haves and have-nots. It's well-intentioned, but based on myths. It's help that does not help, and anyone who's tried to feed a family off of food stamps will see that in an instant. What saddens me the most is how much people on each side of this gulf don't know each other. It's time to start a new conversation.
Lake Effect SAS Young Kim is the executive director of the Fondue Food Center and the urban foodie columnist at urbanmilwaukee.com. Coming up next, the search for planets outside of our solar system that could support life is one of the big ongoing efforts in astronomy. We'll talk to one of the leading researchers in the field next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWAM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Any successful search for extraterrestrial life that is similar to that here on Earth requires finding planets outside of our solar system that could support it. There are many thousands of planets within observable distance to the Earth, but most of these exoplanets do not have the requisite Earth-like properties to sustain carbon-based life forms. Dr. David Latham is leading a team at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics that is confirming the existence of exoplanets that are similar to Earth. He was also in Milwaukee in April to give the 8th annual COIN lecture in astronomy and astrophysics at Marquette University. He stopped by the Lake Effect studio then to explain how his specific research fits into the greater search for Earth-like planets.
I like to say that we live at a very special time in the history of astronomy. We are poised to find planets enough like the Earth that we could imagine them being comfortable for life as we know it. I don't mean the giant planets, the gas giants like Jupiter, which are big and easy to detect and characterize. I'm talking about small planets, ones that might be rocky, could have surfaces, could have water, on the surface if they are at the right distance from their host star. So the temperature could be right. The water could be liquid. There could be secondary atmospheres. The original atmosphere of light gases like hydrogen and helium have blown away and been replaced by more interesting atmospheres with molecules like water and carbon dioxide, the kind of material you need for, I call it, the invention of life. And we're very close to being able to do that, to identify, discover, and even characterize such planets, and hopefully do spectroscopy of their atmospheres so we can learn what kind of an atmosphere they have. There's even some hope that someday we should be able to detect molecules that are the product of life. If there's enough life, such as we have here on Earth, to influence the biosphere, create molecules of gases that we could detect, then by remote sensing, we could see if there are signs of life on those planets. So that's the long-range picture I have.
Which is just fantastic. Even though in our lifetimes, it's unlikely we could ever get to any of those planets once they're identified. But just knowing they're out there and that there might be other beings doing similar things that we are.
Yes, it's the great question. Are we alone?
Right now, I'm assuming that the work you're doing is looking for characteristics that we would recognize as life. Is that correct?
Well, that's the easiest thing to do. It's like the drunk looking for his keys under the lamppost. So we're starting by looking for life that is carbon-based chemistry and needs liquid water, we think. But actually, we have to consider a larger set of possibilities. And I'm part of an initiative called the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative, which is a multidisciplinary effort involving people studying how to make cells, biochemists, and astronomers. And the role of the astronomers is to characterize the sorts of planets that might be out there in our galaxy and to determine whether the atmospheres are like the ones we're used to in the solar system or whether there might be other global geochemistries. And the whole idea is to restrict the possibilities for these people trying to figure out how to make life by telling them something about the raw materials that they have to work with.
How do you look for something that we don't know what it looks like? If there is a different sort of life, what kind of markers would you maybe expect to see that you'd say, well, maybe this might be life, but it might not be life the way we think of life?
We're actually having enough trouble figuring out what molecules might be good markers for life as we know it. That's an area of very active research. And thinking of what would be markers for life that we don't understand the biochemistry for, that's kind of outside the box right now. We're trying to do the easy problem. But the first step is to find planets that are enough like the Earth that we might have a chance of finding signs of life, the kind of life that we know.
So as an astronomer, how do you do that? What tools do you use to find those planets?
Well, right now, all the action is in the study of transiting planets. These are planets that happen to pass between us and their star, so we see them blocking some light. And that gives us an idea of the size of the planet compared to the size of the star because we see what fraction of the starlight is blocked. And if we can also measure the masses using the Doppler shift, Doppler velocities, radial velocities, then we have the mass and the size, and that gives us the bulk properties, for example, the density, because that depends just on mass and radius, and the surface gravity for that matter. And those are the planets where we are focusing our attention now. And the key tools are space missions, NASA space missions, one that's been in operation for 4 years now called the Kepler mission, been a very successful mission. And it is exploring the population of small planets. Its goal is to find out the frequency of Earth-like planets. It was built to do that job. It stares at just one area on the sky, 1/400th of the sky. So the next step after Kepler is another space mission called the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. That'll survey the whole sky because undoubtedly Kepler has missed the nearest and brightest planets, transiting planets. And those will be the primary targets for finding terrestrial-like planets, planets like the Earth, maybe bigger, easier to detect and characterize. And those are the ones where we hope that we might be able to study the atmospheres remotely.
Let's assume that everything happens as it's supposed to, and in 2017 the launch happens. How quickly will you begin getting data? Right away?
Right away, in the first month or two. The strategy is to cover the whole sky, and we do that with a set of four wide-angle cameras, and they stare at one part of the sky for a month. So we only find short-period planets, 10 or 20 days. So if they are orbiting a star like the sun, they'll be much too hot for life. But if they're orbiting much smaller, cooler stars, then the zone where water could be liquid is much shorter, can be as short as a couple of weeks. Rather different from the year that you used to here on the Earth. Annual year, yearly orbit would only be 2 weeks. So we'll get results pretty quickly, and they will be made public within 6 months so the whole community can work on the new candidates, the new bright nearby prime targets for studying transiting planets.
When you say nearby, how many light years are we talking?
Oh, well, they're still quite far away, 20, 50, even 100 light years away.
So, again, no real possibility of visiting any of them. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a long time before we send anybody to Alpha Centauri, the nearest star system. We might send probes there eventually, but it's not against the law of physics, but it may be against the law of economics. Will our society be interested in funding that kind of endeavor?
Are they fascinated enough to give money? I mean, I guess that's the big question, you know, to motivate governments to actually fund this kind of research.
Well, NASA Astrophysics, which is all of astronomy and astrophysics supported by NASA, recently chose the test mission, an exoplanet mission. It was the only full mission that they chose in this particular round of competition that started 2 years ago. It's a long journey from the initial submission, 36 proposals in competition, down to two for the last year. Our concept study report went in last September, and there's a long process that leads to the selection of missions, and NASA is focused on exoplanets as one of the most interesting areas of science to support. And I think that's a reflection of the public interest.
In the information that I received about the talk that you're going to be giving here, it talks about ground-based observations as well. We've been talking about the Kepler and space-based observations. What kinds of things can you observe here on Earth about these exoplanets?
Well, there is a niche for ground-based observations of the very smallest and coolest and reddest M-dwarf stars, they're called. And there is a very nice project led by David Charbonneau at Harvard called the MIRTH Project, M-Earth, but it's pronounced MIRTH. And that is a project to use the littlest stars to search for transiting planets, where the depth of the dip in the light curve, the amount, the fraction of the area blocked is much larger. And so you can do it through the Earth's atmosphere. And that's already led to one very interesting result, something that is six times the mass of the Earth. And it's not a rocky planet like the Earth, but we're getting closer now. That's the most interesting one so far. And that came from ground-based observations, a relatively inexpensive project, about $1 million worth of telescopes, a fleet of eight telescopes looking at about 2,000 targets all over the northern sky. So that work to identify interesting candidates was done from the ground. But the most important work that can be done from the ground is the follow-up to measure the masses of the planets. That requires spectrographs on large telescopes. We have a new facility for doing that kind of work on La Palma and the Canary Islands called HARPS North, measuring velocities at a precision of 1 meter per second or even better.
Wow.
But that's not good enough to find something like the Earth. You need to do 10 times better than that to see the motion of the sun in response to the pull of the Earth in its orbit. You need something like 9 centimeters per second. We hope someday to achieve that kind of performance, and we have plans for doing that from the ground with the Giant Magellan Telescope, which might come into operation 10 years from now. The first light instrument on that telescope will be designed to measure velocities down to the precision needed to detect a true Earth twin. Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Yes.
Yeah.
But will the stars let us do that? The stars themselves have a kind of jitter. They have motions in their atmospheres, or they have rotation with dark spots that come and go, and that distorts the spectrum and makes a signal that looks kind of like an orbital motion. So we have to figure out how to deal with those astrophysical effects. One of the great challenges right now in extrasolar planets.
And is that only from ground-based observation, or does that that's also affecting the space-based as well?
That would affect the space-based observations as well. I don't think we're going to see giant telescopes and spectrographs in space for this kind of work. I think it will be done from the ground. And that's because we can work through the Earth's atmosphere, and it would be prohibitively expensive to put a giant telescope into space. Even the James Webb Space Telescope wouldn't be suitable for this kind of work. But it will be great for following up the spectroscopy of the atmosphere. So studying atmospheres of rocky planets is one of the great goals for the James Webb Space Telescope, in my view.
And it sounds like all of these things are, while they're working on their own individual missions, they're working in concert in a way to try basically to find another Earth.
Yes. And we're going to do it. And I'm planning to be involved or at least still be alive when it happens. In other words, you can tell that it might happen in the next decade, that we will confirm rocky planets that are enough like the Earth. They could be considered as possible abodes for life.
Fantastic. David Latham, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and talking about this fascinating research, and best of luck with it all.
It was my pleasure.
Dr. David Latham is a senior astronomer at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory and is leading a team at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics that is searching for and confirming the existence of exoplanets with Earth-like characteristics. He was in Milwaukee this spring to give the 8th annual COIN lecture in astronomy and astrophysics at Marquette University, and he spoke to us then. What the study of eye disease has in common with the study of stars, well, that's coming up next on Lake Effect for Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we spoke with physicist David Latham about the ongoing search for exoplanets that could support life as we understand it. Meanwhile, a Milwaukee researcher is using a technology often linked to the way we see distant stars and planets and applying it to the way we see, period. Joe Carroll specializes in using what are known as adaptive optics to diagnose and potentially deal with eye disease. Carroll is the co-director of the Advanced Ocular Imaging Program at the Medical College of Wisconsin's Eye Institute. He gave a working definition of the technology to Lake Effect's Mitch Teich.
Adaptive optics is a technique that allows you to correct for imperfections when you're trying to image something. In the case of astronomy, when you're trying to image stars or planets or satellites, the imperfections come from the Earth's atmosphere. This technology was transferred to ophthalmology when you're trying to image the inside of the eye. Those imperfections come from the cornea and the lens, or the front part of the eye. And so adaptive optics can be used to correct for those imperfections as well.
And so is this extrapolating data or is this correcting the data? I mean, is this taking what we know about what's there and what we know about what's not visible and converting from one to the other, or is it literally a fix?
So it literally is a fix. If you think of customized LASIK surgery, which I'm sure you've heard of,
sure,
that's a form of adaptive optics, although it's a permanent fix. You measure exactly how the front part of the eye is distorting light, and you surgically correct for it. In the case of adaptive optics, we still measure how the front part of the eye is distorting light, but we do a temporary fix using a mirror that simply allows us to get a high-resolution picture at one moment in time, and it doesn't permanently change the person's vision in any way.
Well, and so what are the limitations in conventional imaging done with eyes that that adaptive optics seek to correct?
Our eyes are an imperfect device. As well as we think we see, the reality is our eyes are not very good optical devices. A famous scientist, Hermann von Helmholtz, once said if he had paid somebody to build this device, he would have promptly returned it and asked for his money back. And so adaptive optics is taking into account the fact that the cornea and the lens have imperfections in their structure. And so when light passes through these structures, rather than passing through in nice uniform waves, they get disrupted and distorted or bent in all sorts of different directions. And so by the time light arrives at the retina, that is the tissue inside of your eye that's responsible for seeing, by the time light gets there, it's distorted in such a way that makes the image anything but perfect. And adaptive optics seeks to bring back the perfection in the image that's arriving at the retina.
So are doctors missing things? Are they just not able to pinpoint things well enough? What's the impact of this been?
Well, absolutely. Both the doctors and the patients are missing things. By the time a patient notices, in many cases, that they have a problem with their vision, significant damage has already occurred to their retina. And in some cases, in some diseases, this may be as many as half of the cells in their retina are gone, and they're not coming back. So this really puts the physician at a disadvantage when treating those diseases, that by the time the patient shows up at their door and says, I can't see, they're already behind the eight ball. And so what this does is allows us to bring the detection phase of a disease to a much, much earlier portion of the disease, when maybe only a few cells have degenerated or died before the patient might even be aware of it. And that's really an exciting phase in ophthalmology, is to start treating diseases before the patient ever really realizes something's wrong.
Well, and so let me ask you maybe a dumb question. If the patient doesn't know anything is wrong, why is the patient going in and having his or her eyes checked out to begin with?
Well, a lot of people are going to be going in for annual eye exams, or because there's a family history of an eye disease. Glaucoma is a great case where there's good, strong evidence that there's it's inherited. Age-related macular degeneration is another condition where if you have a grandparent or a great-grandparent with the condition, you yourself are at risk. And so you might consider getting an eye exam or advanced imaging on a more regular basis than, say, someone who has no family history or other risk factors for a condition.
So this technology, though, is at the verge of being able to be used by doctors on a more routine basis.
Well, on the verge is a relative depiction. We certainly hope so, and that's one of the missions of the Advanced Ocular Imaging Program, is to accelerate the translation of the imaging technology into more mainstream applications. Right now, there's fewer than about 24 of these devices in the world, and we've been really trying to pioneer dissemination of the technology to multiple centers around the world, to get more physicians on board, to really help them see the power of adaptive optics imaging and what that can do for their understanding and of different diseases and their management of their particular patient populations.
Would you anticipate this as a case of demand driving the supply? If more doctors and more patients demand that this technology be more commonly used, the supply and the availability of it will follow?
Absolutely. I think that's happened in the past couple of years. We've had a couple of companies that have built prototype devices on the heels of some really exciting advances that we've made and other groups have made in understanding about fundamental aspects of eye disease. And patients as well are getting more and more savvy in terms of availability of information on the internet. They can read about adaptive optics. They can see the images that we're up to. They can see what we've done, and they ask about it. And we're lucky at the Eye Institute, when they ask their physician about adaptive optics, our physicians can say, well, it's actually just right upstairs. So if you'd like to be imaged, we can certainly facilitate that.
What's making these advances possible today? Adaptive optics itself is not a brand new concept, but what has changed that is allowing you and the researchers who are driving this to make these advances?
Right. So adaptive optics itself was first proposed back in the 50s and actually wasn't implemented until the 60s and 70s by the Defense Department. And so it is an old technology. And what's really changed, I think, was a willingness or an acceptance by ophthalmologists to embrace new technology. And I think that was especially true here at the Medical College, where we've been lucky to have this interdisciplinary group of engineers and biologists who historically speak very different languages. But by putting them all in the same space, we've created an environment where people aren't afraid of the technology. And likewise, the engineers aren't fearful of the biology. And I think that's why we've sort of seen a growth in this development of the technology over the past few years, is other centers are now seeing the value of combining engineering with biology, two unlikely bedfellows, if you will.
We hear a lot about the idea of the silo mentality, and this sounds like another example of that breaking down.
It's a perfect example. And, Milwaukee's a great example of a place where we've combated that mentality of having these individual silos with places like Marquette, UWM, MSOE, and the medical college. You have what appear to be silos, but real actually very good collaboration through – we have a CTSI grant that allows the institutions to interact with each other on a very – on a very real basis, not just a sort of on paper type of a format.
You mentioned a couple of specific diseases and conditions. You mentioned glaucoma. You mentioned macular degeneration. Can you give us a sense for how the paradigm is likely to change with those conditions? I mean, what – walk us through how adaptive optics will change the game for people with those.
Sure. Well, maybe I'll introduce a different set of diseases, and that would be the hereditary retinal degenerations. And then maybe we can talk about glaucoma or AMD. In the case of hereditary retinal degenerations, for years the answer has been there's nothing we can do. Go seek low vision services. Prepare to lose your vision. And what's really where I think another factor that's prepared the community to accept an imaging technology like adaptive optics is there are now therapies for those conditions. The problem is knowing who to give which therapy to and how to assess whether the therapy is working. And that's where adaptive optics and similar imaging technologies will be really instrumental, is you have to know if you're going to, say, use a gene therapy for a particular condition, are there cells in the retina that are going to be there to receive the gene therapy that you're introducing, or have they died completely? And until now, we haven't had the technology to answer that question. Likewise, once you've injected a gene therapy into someone's eye, how do you assess whether it's working? Typical therapies would take 5 to 7 years to figure out, have you meaningfully changed their vision? Whereas with something like adaptive optics, we could image the patient immediately post-surgery, a week, month, 6 months, what have you, and assess how have we changed the structure that would then be predictive of a subsequent change in function. So that's really going to change the way we treat eye disease.
I was just going to interrupt. I imagine also being able to do this much earlier in the process is useful.
Absolutely. As with any disease, the earlier you intervene, the better the outcome is going to be. So then take a case like glaucoma, where glaucoma, it's estimated that by the time you notice a defect in your peripheral vision, that is your vision off to the side, the estimate is about half of your ganglion cells, that is the cells that transmit the electrical impulse to your brain, are gone. And so in glaucoma, really, the holy grail has been an early non-invasive biomarker for the disease. And we've relied on very subjective or indirect measurements that tell us maybe this eye is unhealthy, but we're not quite sure, so we're going to go ahead and give this person a bunch of eye drops. And of course, in glaucoma, once you start taking eye drops to manage your eye pressure, you're on them for life. And that's not really an effective strategy for treating disease. It manages the disease, but it doesn't truly treat the disease. So the more we can learn about, in this case, glaucoma on a cellular level, the better equipped we are to actually treat the disease, not simply – just not manage it.
So people are used to a certain set of machines when they go in for their typical eye exam. How different is the actual physical equipment that goes into adaptive optics versus what people are used to?
Well, it's quite different, and that's one of the things we had in mind when we built the Advanced Ocular Imaging Program, was to create a space that didn't look as different as a regular ophthalmologist's office. So we took steps to make – we created a waiting room. We prettied up the instruments so it didn't look like the basement of an engineering lab, which is really what it was. We created an environment that looked more clinical because we knew we were going to be bringing through patients into this setting. But when you look at the device, it's covered in a box. You can't really see the inside. But when we take off the box, then you know it's different. It's basically a microscope with its insides all spread out on a table. And when patients come through for imaging, some of them want to learn about the device. And it's actually a great opportunity to educate patients about the technology that they're being imaged with. Whereas when they're in a regular clinic, they don't have that opportunity to learn what's being done to them down to the very specific detail.
I imagine there is a certain significant learning curve for people in the ophthalmology field to be able to interpret the results of this kind of equipment.
There is, and that's – you know, the picture is the first half of the story. Once you've got an image of someone's retina, the challenge really is how do we interpret this? And in many cases, what's been difficult is we're seeing things that no one has ever seen before. We're redefining eye disease and what we thought we knew about a particular condition and how it evolves and how it starts. in some cases turns out to be completely wrong. In other cases, turns out to be completely confusing. And so this is where we need the third arm. We have the engineers, the biologists, but then we need the doctors, the MDs, the ones that have the historical clinical experience, the pathology experience that can help us interpret the images. And so it's that trifecta that we have within our imaging program that helps us interpret the images quite readily.
Fascinating stuff. Joe Carroll, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Joe Carroll is co-director of the Advanced Ocular Imaging Program at the Medical College of Wisconsin's Eye Institute. He spoke with Mitch Teich. There's a link to more about adaptive optics at wuwm.com/lake effect. We'll take one last break, and then an essayist has some thoughts on the double-edged sword that is technology. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect returns now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Our last two segments were both in part about how technology is making the work of researchers easier. And technology has obviously allowed us to do things today that our ancestors would not have even dreamed of. But essayist George Burdes wonders if these advances have really made our lives better.
Joan Chittister has long been one of my favorite writers and always leads me to new insights and heights of understanding. Her most recent effort centered, of all things, on a bathtub. And what she did was hammer home an important fact of life in this speedway, helter-skelter 21st century of ours. This is the way she put it. Just imagine this. The cast iron bathtub was first produced in 1870. The telephone went commercial in 1887. So, if you had been born in 1870, you could have spent 17 years in the bathtub without being interrupted by the telephone. That charming, oh, so provocative story rang the bell in my belfry that holds modern technology at arm's length. Yes, like all of us, I indulge, perhaps surrender to, is the better way of saying it. Within limits, I'm a man of my time. Sort of. Computers, TVs, cell phones, and a few other gadgets somehow or other have crept into my house over the years. One thing for sure, though, and contrary to advertised claims, they are not always my servants. And in fact, too often they become my master. For example, when my computer decides to have a nervous breakdown, it takes me along for the bumpy ride into Neverland. Its lesser spasms are also contagious. Look, it's not that I want to indulge myself for 17 years by luxuriating in the bathtub without being interrupted by the ringing telephone. But even that marvelous invention, the telephone, offers another example of periodic growing estrangement. What has always been a love affair with anything that brings me into closer contact with my children and close friends is becoming the infamous third party in a threatening divorce. You can also spell that T-U-R-D. One especially annoying example is the service known as call waiting. You know call waiting, don't you? Well, you should, because you're the one who waits. That's the ill-mannered means of interrupting an ongoing phone chat, putting the person to whom you're talking on hold, and answering the incoming call. In effect, it says, "Hey, you wait. Someone else is calling me. And without knowing who it is, I'm going to make you waste your time while I find out who it is." Now, that's not my definition of manners or respect. Contrarily, if for whatever reason you're picky about whom you do not want to talk to, there's that service known as caller ID. That's akin to the peephole in the front door. With caller ID, there are no surprises. If you don't want to talk, you don't have to. The persona non grata caller is cold-shouldered without even knowing it. those are just two small examples of the technology puppy that has grown into a hound dog eating us out of house and home. Notice I haven't even mentioned cell phones. Yet, yes, I have one, but I still take my pictures with a camera using that old-fashioned thing called film. For the same reason I never bought a wireless G broadband router, a Sony 4GB video MP3 player, or a 5510 cordless desktop and optical mouse combo. And while I have a lap, it is not topped. Yes, I know you're probably concluding that I don't iPad text message or have a strawberry, Blackberry, that's what it's called. Anyway, you're right. Such overwhelming odds may seem to put me at a disadvantage in today's world and lagging behind the parade, but as I see it, entering the race and submitting to the whip of every new gadget puts those who succumb at peril. Going online and all that implies in today's technological world can too often result in being hung out to dry on that line. No, I'm not going to turn off or throw out my phone and sit in a bathtub for the rest of my life. But this is for absolute sure. I'm not going to get out of that bathtub to answer the phone. So call me prehistoric, if you will. Call me out of touch, passed by, blind resistor, or any other designation. But please, please do not call me after 10 p.m.
Essayist George Burdi spends part of the year in Milwaukee and the warmer months in the North Woods. Many of Essay's originally ran in a weekly series on WXPR and Rhinelander. There's a link to the full collection at his blog, East of Eagle River, from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. Mm-hmm.